Hey everyone, I'm Jay.
I'm Sophia.
I'm Scott, and welcome to Witches Betwixt.
So today, we have a special guest with us, someone that we have referenced a lot because he lives with Scott. Yay! It's Darian. Darian is Scott's boyfriend, and he is also a witch. No surprises there. We haven't done kind of like a witch community spotlight in quite some time. Like, I know we did one way back when Sophia came into the podcast, and I know we did one a while ago about Joyce being new to witchcraft and whatnot. But we haven't really done any of them since, and I feel like right now is a good time to reach out to people to kind of continue that series, since everyone's isolated, laid off, quarantined, whatever the case is. Now is kind of a good time to reach out to people and see, you know, just let's stop talking about all the nonsense that's going on. Let's just talk about witchcraft, and let's just talk about, you know, stuff that makes us feel good. So naturally, Darian was pretty accessible, considering that we have a direct line of communication with him. And it's actually really funny because the whole reason that this kind of was inspired is that I said, hey, what do we want to record? And Sophia said, dragons. And I was like, okay. and Scott was like, oh, well, Darian does a lot of dragon magic and stuff and would love to talk about that, and is actually not working. And actually, you know, has, I shouldn't say not working, you work every day because you're an essential employee, but he was off today, so we have him here with us, and that is super cool. So Darian, who the hell are you?
Well, my name is Darian, that's for starters. Essentially, I am a, my pronouns as a practitioner are very, I'd say very, very fluid.
Mm-hmm.
As the source of my dragons, I actually prefer sorcerer.
Okay.
But when it comes to when I work with deities, as I am comedic, I am, by technicality, I would be an acolyte.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like your title, is what you were kind of saying. So yeah. It's, you kind of work, so your magical practice is kind of split, I suppose, between dragon magic and comedicism?
At the moment, yes.
Okay. Let's actually start with the comedicism, because I feel like it's something that not a lot of our viewers may be entirely tuned into and necessarily know what it is. So first, let's start off, what is comedicism for the listeners?
Comedicism is what is essentially the ancient Egyptian religious practices. It is called Kemet, and it's very, unfortunately, it has been lost to the sands of time, pun intended. But
I liked it. It was good.
There's very not much known. Like, after a certain point, a lot of things are gone. It's very unfortunate, but what we do have, thanks to raiders of people's tombs,
mm-hmm.
and certain papyri and funerary stone slabs, we know certain things. Just to clarify, papyri is a form of paper.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people don't understand what papyri is.
I feel like maybe.
I feel like it's related to papyrus, hence.
Yeah.
It kind of makes sense.
It's worth saying at any level.
It is, yeah. Document.
But, I mean, it sounds a lot like even, like, certain traditional styles of craft as well. It's kind of like a reconstruction.
Yeah.
It's very, like, so, like, it seems like comedicism is a reconstructionist tradition, like...
Mm-hmm. Because when you look at the timeline of Egypt, they've only been free for, actually, 100 years. They gained their freedom in the 1920s, and they've been... Well, they, let me rephrase that. Not freedom, but independence in the 1920s.
Yeah, who were they? Before then, Who are they ruled by?
It varies from century to century. I think recently was the British.
Really? I actually
Yeah, I
did
was gonna
not
say,
know
I was
that.
pretty sure it was the British. That's what I thought at
Always
least.
the British.
Yeah.
It was the British,
No
yeah.
bragging on British, but unfortunately they have a very large
History's
tendency to,
history, it's
yeah,
okay.
history is history.
Yeah, they have a pretty
But
strong imperialism streak in their history.
They also had a very heavy presence in Africa in World War II.
Basically, World War II with Africa was who wants to get split? How do we split this continent into who owns who?
Exactly.
Which
There's a lot of
is
bullshit. So yeah, I actually did not know that Egypt was fairly recently independent, even though they're like one of the oldest nate like civilizations, you know, like on this planet. That's so interesting.
It is very unfortunate. I would love to go to Egypt, but they're currently going through a civil war, so.
Are they really?
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's there's a lot of turmoil over there in Egypt.
Oh, is that because of the Israel and all of that stuff?
I don't believe so. No, it's civil, not.
Israel's
Oh.
quite a ways away. It has to do with like the government of Egypt, if I am aware of
Yeah,
what was happening
gotcha.
correctly.
That was me being in our head. I apologize.
I'm not up to date currently on the political structure of Egypt, but I definitely make it a point to look every once in a while.
I am actually curious if you, I'm not saying that you're an expert on Egypt, Darian, but I'm curious if you know, what is the dominant religion in Egypt? Is it Islam? It is?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wasn't sure, because I don't, because, like, I'm thinking, like, in Scandinavian countries, like, they don't really, like, the predominant religion is not, you know, like, the old Nordic gods or
Way,
anything like that. But I
if I
figured it
remember
might be the
correctly,
same for Egypt.
introduced into Egypt was by its conquerors from the Ottoman Empire, took over Egypt,
And that brought
and then that's
Islam
how.
over.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and unfortunately, the Ottoman Empire was like, submit to our religion or die.
Yeah, sounds about right.
So my question is, like, how well did the, if you know, I actually don't know if you know this, but I'm curious if you do. You surprise me with your knowledge all the time. How much, I'm trying to say here is, how much of the Kemetic religion was reconstructed in Egypt? Like, I know in Greece there is like a large, like a growing number of people reviving the Hellenic tradition. Are there any people attempting to revive in Egypt the Egyptian?
That I don't know. I would love to, like, if that's the case, I would love to, like, be a part of that kind of thing. And I know many of other Kemeticists would love to be a part of that. I can't be thinking of that. I'm gonna look that up later.
I'm scared.
know, we're going down a rabbit hole already. So with Kemeticism, what I guess when did your interest in it start, and where did it kind of come from?
So, growing up, I've always been a devourer of myths, and that's very, very funny when it comes to comedics. Basically, I've learned as many myths as I can growing up from Japan, China, Mesoamerica, America, Europe, Egypt, some other African other African areas, which is unfortunate. A lot of African things are verbal, so it's not much written writing down.
Right, yeah, a lot of it is
So
oral
my
tradition.
That's also like a lot
one
of Native
favorite
American or indigenous stuff. Like, it's all word of mouth.
like my favorite African tale is the stories of Anansi,
Yeah.
which more popular people will realize what's his name? Mr. Nancy from American Gods, which
Oh,
is still my
yes.
favorite character. And Anansi has always been my favorite. It's just the spider thing always freaked me out, but that's besides the point.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually learned some of those myths in school, in like our English textbooks. We had a couple of them in there.
I actually had a friend sit down and read me that book one day when we were in a cafe. She was like, "Oh, do you know this story?" And she read it, and it was really interesting. I it was really captivating. I quite liked it.
Stories from the world are always very captivating. Though, when it comes to Kimeticism, it's another unfortunate thing, because when it comes to stuff on Egypt, it's either muddled from certain pharaoh's rule, or, like, for me, one pharaoh that personally don't like, I despise this pharaoh, is, his name is Akhenaten. And he is the father of the more famous Tutankhamun. And Akhenaten basically tried to establish monotheism among the Egyptian people.
I'm assuming that did not go over well.
No, it did not. As soon as he died and Tutankhamun came in, Tutankhamun really institutionalized polytheism. And the composite deity of Amun-Ra.
But from my understanding, it was more like a monotheistic Egyptian religion. Like, it wasn't an Abrahamic faith. It was turning what was a polytheistic tradition into a monotheistic.
Yes, that's exactly what was happening.
Which is interesting. I didn't actually know that that was the trajectory of how that went down.
Yeah, but Tutankhamun was a spiteful little brat. So, screw daddy. Polytheism all around. Then he got mauled by a hippo, but that's besides the point.
You had mentioned that you were really drawn to myths, and you devoured myths and folklore from all sorts of cultures. But what was it in particular about Egyptian myth and folklore that captivated you so much to pursue Kemeticism?
Well, it's funny. My pursuit of it is very strange. I have, years ago, and this is more or less the story of how magic came into my life. I kind of just started out doing very, Scott put it, I was doing magic without knowing I was doing magic.
That's fair. A lot of us have that experience.
Yeah,
I was just telling him that the other day. I said, you know, there's different schools of people. You know, I said, you know, there's some of us who start doing spell work, and then you later find out, oh, hey, I was doing that before I even knew that was a thing. And then there are people like me who it's like, you know, it starts out with the psychic stuff, right? Like, I talk to my, you know, dead grandmom who's been dead for 50 years, you know, like, and then there's, you know, the people who, you know, who whatever, you know, just spiritual searching. Like, there's like different schools of people. But he was one of those people who just seemed to really get into it.
And it wasn't really cool. Until I met you that it really, those seedlings finally blossomed into something. And I still remember the first time I encountered an Egyptian deity, who is my patron. Very funny recount. Me and him were walking home from work, and then all of a sudden, some particular unfriendly fae creatures decided to attack us. And
fae creatures.
Yeah, you don't remember this as much as I do, which is hilarious how you don't remember things. But yeah, I do. I've had essentially a scorpion in Poxy that I've had for very, very long time. It's always been my best thing, and it turned out to be a shell for a spirit who was also a worker, who was also connected to my patron.
And who is your patron?
My patron is Anubis, which when you find with a lot of other comedics, it's very funny.
Is it common for him to be the first one to come to people?
To my knowledge, and from my experience,
from experience. Yeah.
Yes. You would think of all the gods in the Egyptian pantheon, the god of dead would be the easiest one to work with. But he is. He really is the easiest one to work with.
If I could say something interesting to that, I've said on here before, I have quite a few friends that are in the ATRs, and that actually seems like a theme in a lot of the African traditional religions and the Afro-Caribbean traditional systems, certain spirits and deities of their tradition seem to come to people first to welcome them or invite them to the tradition to come and get initiations and things. So that's interesting.
Maybe like Anubis is like the welcome party.
Yeah, definitely the welcome party. And then through various meditations and bunch of head slaps, eventually I found my matron, who turned out to be a 2-for-1 deal. Mm. This is Hathor, and when it comes to Hathor and the other two goddesses associated, Hathor, Shekhmet, and Bast, or Baset in some people's languages, their history is very, it depends on what translation you're going on.
Mm-hmm.
With me, I always say that because it's always a translation thing.
Mm-hmm.
Either a different stone slab says something else. Effectively, if you ever read the story of why Ra plucked out his eye turned out to be Shekhmet, who is the goddess of violence, blood, war, and pestilence.
Mm-hmm.
And out of a fit of rage, she ravaged across Egypt because the humans disrespected her father, so they deserved to pay. But then she was just killing everyone. Everyone. So Ra and the other gods made a concoction of alcohol and a little bit of blood to make it look more like blood, and when Shekhmet drank it, she passed out. Then Ra took some of her essence out, and she either calmed down and turned into Hathor, or she calmed down and turned into Baset.
Oh.
Depending on the story.
So. Yes, depending on the story. And there's also a different story where her essence gets taken out and formed into a new goddess, either one of the two.
I thought that she was Hathor first, and then transformed into Shekhmet. That's interesting.
So though personally, I do like the more idea of a goddess of love, fertility, sex, and drunkenness and parties into the violent war goddess.
It makes kind of sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Almost the exact reverse of like love and sex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and fertility, you know, it's war and death and wrath, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how did Anubis initially present himself to you again?
So I actually remember this now. We were at the park.
Yes.
FDR Park here in South Philly. And we were walking past one of the older buildings, and I don't know if they were fae creatures. They were some type of spirit that we both kind of felt at the same time, and we both started getting lightheaded and really dizzy. And it was later at night. We were just taking a stroll, and these things, I suddenly saw this like silver flash in the corner of my eye, but it was towards the park, and it was at nighttime, and the park is closed. There was no one in the park. Mm-hmm. But it was like, when I say a silver flash, it was like up against my face. It was really weird. Mm. And like I said, we started getting really lightheaded, and it was like very common symptoms of psychic or spiritual attack. And it was something, and then you know this part better than I do. I know you mentioned your scarab and the
scorpion.
The scorpion. Oh, scorpion, thank you. Your scorpion in the epoxy. And I know that, what was the spirit that began kind of presenting itself? This part I don't remember.
Well, the spirit that was in the scorpion was also a servitor of Anubis.
Mm.
And through you, he was explaining himself and basically how, like, oh no, Anubis chose you. Get ready for that.
Well, I remember it was really symbolic, though. You knew certain symbols, things that I was saying. I didn't come out and say Anubis.
No. You were saying various things.
I don't remember
things.
All of it. I just remember, like, I remember it was, like, really weird. You had to kind of piece things together, but you knew pretty quickly. You're really good with the whole mythology thing.
So, yeah. With all the myth and folklore that you were studying, did you have like a particular affinity toward Egyptian myth and folklore over any of the other stuff, or was this kind of like a surprise to you when this happened?
It was more or less a surprise. I didn't have an affinity for anything. I Before I met Anubis, I was a very, 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 very simple energy worker. I stress the word very. But then it's funny because even after a point, I knew I had more. Growing up, would I really have a the reason one of the reasons why I had a connection to like myths and such is because one of the things growing up was dragons. All kinds of dragons. But the wingless, not wingless, claws, no claws, teeth, no teeth. Love dragons ever since I was very little.
And there's
And
tons and tons of myth and folklore from all kinds of from pretty much everywhere in the world, there is some mention of a dragon or dragon type creature.
And that's one of the things why how I got drawn to like myths of the world. Though Egypt does have something that's I wouldn't say dragon-like, but it's definitely not something. Unfortunately, I cannot say it. Listening, I am on the Witches Betwixt, and out of sheer
Is it that
curiosity,
you can't say it because you're on the podcast, or because like you can't say it to us at all?
in myth.
So in Kemeticism, words have power. Your word, every word you speak has a meaning to it, no matter what it is. Even me speaking right now has a sim. I have power with just the words I speak, and names have even greater power.
So you're
And
saying
this
that
entity,
if you verbally said the name of the entity, you could potentially summon it forth. It's kind of like what you're saying.
yes and no.
Okay.
This being dwells in the night, and it is currently nighttime. If anyone knows the story of Ra and his nightly journey, you know the being I'm referring to. Even in writing, I can't even write out the whole name. I have to make slashes on each letter.
As I just proceed to go to Google to go look this up right now.
I have a question. Would you say that, like, saying the name wasn't necessarily a conjuration, but more like a sign of ill omen? Like, is it more like a curse, less of like a conjuration?
Kind of, yes.
Like, bad things would begin to happen because you invocate its name. And then it kind of turns its eye upon you metaphorically. And
Yes.
okay.
So one of the things, so this entity is the embodiment of primordial chaos. Now, yes, there is an Egyptian god of chaos. There's quite a few of them. It is not Set.
Right, yeah, I know not that I know a lot about Set, but you hear Set a lot when you look into Egyptian myth and stuff like that.
Because there was only that two things that he'd done, but that's besides the point.
Yeah, 'cause Set likes to fuck shit up. That's what he likes.
It's
He's like
god of
Loki of Egyptian myth.
actually kind of because he is the god of the
He's a
desert
trickster,
wind.
right?
Not necessarily trickster, not in that sense. He's war, the desert, the red sand of the desert, forging, and fire. If that's one of the things, his one of his concepts. I know there's more, I just don't remember. A lot of people always think that Set is the Egyptian devil, which he's not. No. I'm on the stand firm belief of no.
In
Set isn't the devil.
Kemeticism, is there a concept of a devil, or is it just a polytheistic, like each god has their own territory and their own thing that they work with?
Yes and no. Like every god, like let's talk about magic. So there's at least, to my knowledge, at least five different gods and goddesses of magic.
In Kemeticism.
Like, yes. Like, concepts swish and flow through each god depending on what kind of purpose you're looking for. one of the gods of chaos that would like to work at, but work with, but unfortunately I would like to keep him at a distance, is Sobek. So each god that has a representation of chaos has a different aspect. Set is a god of chaos because he's the untamed wilds of the desert. He takes forms of a hippo or a leopard. While Sobek, on the other hand, is the untamed wilds of the river, of the Nile River. He's the crocodile.
Yeah, I was just going to say, he's the crocodile river. Guy.
Yes, he's also a god of fertility. This is also... But he's very, very temperamental. Completely, you don't know whether he's going to be up or down. He's nice when he comes in, but at the same time, one of the most hilarious thing is after Set chopped up Osiris into 17 pieces, which I still can't make that math out. unfortunately, Sobek ate a piece of Osiris and was shamed for it because he's more primal. He's a primal animal. Of all the gods, he's more primal than animal.
Okay. So he. No, go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say, I've asked him this question before, too. Like, is there an adversarial archetype or an adversarial deity? You know, only because realistically, the only knowledge I have or had of Set was from Luciferianism. I had friends who were involved in the modern, Temple of Set. It's a Luciferian order. They didn't have a great past. Don't go digging too far. From my understanding, it got pretty racist in the very beginning. But they closed down and reopened, and it's no longer the same people. But so that was kind of my... and we used to... What I'm trying to get at is me and him, I would be like, but the Luciferians. And he's like, I don't care.
Like, you're going off the Luciferians, and Luciferians use Egyptian imagery all the time.
Well, because Luciferianism comes to us from the Roman and Greek mystery schools. They were once Helios mystery schools.
Yes,
it's not. Helios.
Though, one thing I would love to point out is the fact that I use the Greco-Roman names of my gods, not because of a lack of trying. I do know their names. They do have Egyptian names.
Yeah.
Like, legit, Anubis isn't Anubis, he's Yanpu. And Hathor is Hathor. I may or may not be saying that right.
But you're an English-speaking person, so, I mean, using that language is not native to you.
Yeah. And I use what's better for pronunciation. It's easier for me to pronounce what it is, how I've learned it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's fair. I mean, like, the only, like, kind of the only modern, I guess, pagan kind of movement that I've seen that really exclusively deals in a foreign language is actually the Urglava tradition of Daish heathenry, which Rob Shriver, he's our local Urglava. I think actually he founded the tradition itself, if I'm not mistaken. But it's based in like Pennsylvania Daish traditions, and their rituals are almost exclusively in German. Which I thought was pretty interesting. And that's kind of like the only modern pagan kind of group that I've seen that doesn't deal in
English.
In English or like, you know, like whatever your native tongue is. Because I know there's like pagans and Wiccans and witches and stuff that, you know, like Spanish is their main, you know, language and stuff like that. But the Urglava tradition, like all of their texts are, it's all split between German and English. It's almost kind of like, if you are joining the Urglava tradition, you are expected to have a certain, you're expected to gain a certain level of mastery of Daish, which I thought was kind of interesting. So, but I guess it makes sense that you're using, I guess, the English translations of these, because it's not your native tongue, so it wouldn't make sense if you used anything else.
I would like to learn, so though if I can find a really great source to find ancient Egyptian, like the language, I would love to find that.
So actually, here's
I would.
my question, and because I don't know if I'm going to sound completely ignorant or not, but like, so in Egypt, their main language is Arabic, correct?
Yes,
Like,
currently.
as of in modern day Egypt, it's Arabic. But ancient Egyptians, it was a completely different language, independent of their nation, correct? Okay. I just wanted to make sure I got that right. So all these, like, you said Anubis is Yampu. Is that like the modern Arabic translation of that, or is that just that's what it would be in the ancient Egyptian language?
That's what it would have been in the Egyptian language, ancient Egyptian language.
That's cool. That's cool. Do we have like a full record of ancient Egyptian of the language that they use? Like, do we have a pretty like cohesive record of that?
Don't know.
Unfortunately, I don't think we do. It's not like Latin,
Right.
where it was practiced enough. Latin got everywhere,
Yeah.
obviously.
And also
But
having
ancient
like
Egyptian.
the Bible in Latin, I'm sure, helped us with our Latin records immensely.
Right. Unfortunately, it is a dead language. I'm not sure how much we know. Once again, I'm not Egyptian buff, but it is a pretty obscure. Like, one of the things I try to help him. I mean, just in research alone, I try to help him a lot because he's very cautious, and I am too with knowledge about ancient Egypt. It's one of those reconstructionist traditions where you have to be really careful about your sources.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things that are just not actually what, not even close to what they would have done. That are just kind of this new age understanding, or a kind of a watered down version of it. And now, of course, there's I don't you know, for a lot of people that's fine, but for Darian chooses to as far as.
Yeah, I try to. Usually my sources are, I try to go for academics usually give me the great enough insight, but unfortunately they're academics and they don't see the metaphysical part aspects of it. They just see this culture as it was, not okay, why is this the way it was, you know?
He really enjoys the book that you and Joyce gave him.
Yes.
Oh, I'm glad.
It allows for him to have. You said it, she's really good at.
Yeah, she understands, like she can take the she has the
Historical.
historical accuracy of it, and she sees it as a practitioner. She sees it through a lens of someone who knows what magic is and what it's like and how it's usually practiced.
What is
Not
the
as
name of that book? Because I do not remember. And who wrote it?
Isis. Call of Isis.
Drop it in the chat when we're done here, because I'll want to put that in the show notes for anyone who's interested in obtaining that book that might want to know more about this.
And I will also drop in another book that Scott gave me. It's called Hecca. It's another book that really helped me along because it's a very, it's not a big book, but it's a very like a medium-sized book, but it's filled with information. Hecca is also the word for magic and the god of magic. Hecca is the god of magic and an aspect of Ra. Most like primal, not most things, but most things are an aspect of Ra. And once you find that Ra isn't spelled RA, it's RE. Which
Really?
when I found that out, yeah, when I first found that out, that kind of blew my mind a little bit.
Huh, I had no idea.
I didn't know that at all.
So I'm curious, with Kemeticism, or I'm kind of curious about the practices of it, right? So, like in Wicca and a lot of even trad witches kind of adopt the eighth Sabbat wheel of the year kind of observance of, you know, major Sabbats or holidays, however you want to phrase it. In Kemeticism, are there holidays? Are there observances? Are there particularly feast days and stuff like that?
Actually, though it does differ. The Kemetic calendar is also based in history.
Mm-hmm.
The calendar is based on the rise and fall of the Nile.
Okay.
You have three seasons. You have the lowering of the Nile, the flooding of the Nile, and the time where you plant.
Mm-hmm.
And those three seasons have, I believe, 4 or 5 months. I don't remember mm-hmm. specifically. I wish I could have grabbed my book before I sat down to record.
That's okay.
I'll remember, but... And I've always made this joke, if I could take off of work for every holiday of the gods I work with, I wouldn't have a job.
Really, there's a lot.
Like, and yeah, there's a lot. There's lots
way
more than the
wheel.
Even
for traditional witches who like cut the wheel and sort of like only do like the four main spokes and they don't do the cross quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Which a lot of trad witches do, like it's
not enough.
My like, God, there's just a lot.
So even if you were a trad witch and you took off for all eight Sabbats plus I don't know every full moon, every full and new moon, that would be what, 26 days plus eight.
Plus the I believe a few, basically I would not have a job.
It's way more than 26.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So like almost every day there's something to do almost every day.
Yes and no, because sometimes it's good to practice, but sometimes it's not good to practice.
Hmm.
Like I have certain auspicious days and where it's good thing to do, but some auspicious days where it's not good to do. And they couldn't even do a day where there's no festivals, no feasts, but there's nothing. Like, Jay, if you remember, the festival / feast that you and Joyce participated in,
mm-hmm.
I actually took a lot of time to plan that out. Albeit mm-hmm. it was really low key and chill, but we were still together and partying it up as much as we cared to do.
I mean, we had food, we were relaxing, having a good time. The ritual was actually quite nice. That was actually the first ritual that was done in my house since I moved in. You were the first one.
Oh, I'm so glad I was able to. Yeah, unfortunately, I still don't know the falsy and dirty joke, so I'm not going to do that one.
Oh, you're fine.
So you're saying, so there's a ton of feast days. So do you observe all of those feast days? I'm not saying like taking off work, but do you do something on each of those feast days?
I try.
You try. Okay.
Another thing I have to remember is it's the reason why priest was a whole job to itself.
Right. Yeah.
Like it's another reason why a priest was also a job right under the pharaoh. If you remember that little pyramid in school, the hierarchy of Egyptian culture, which was true but not true at the same time,
because the pharaoh was considered divine, correct?
Yes.
Yeah,
the pharaoh was considered of divine nature, of human and divine at the same time, because all pharaohs are descendants of the first pharaoh, Horus.
Right. So it wasn't like how the Catholic Church used to be, in that the Pope was the head of it and that was it. But it's kind of like when I think it was Henry VIII when he formed the Anglican Church, where the king was the head of the church versus the Pope. It's kind of like when the Anglicans split off from the Catholic Church, that, you know, the king was the head and the king was considered kind of like the direct line to God versus the Pope. So, mm-hmm. so you're saying that the pharaoh, he's the ruler, but he's also, you know, the guy to go to for all things divine.
More or less, yes.
Hmm. That's really interesting. So the priests were actually really high up in the hierarchy.
Yes. Very much so.
I'm curious, is there any documentation? I've never asked you this before. Is there any documentation of I know in certain priesthoods and pagan traditions there was like a you move up, like a neophyte, an acolyte,
To
and
my knowledge, no. I call myself an acolyte because that's, I feel like that's the most appropriate for me. I don't know if there was a hierarchy in the priesthood. I would love to find like more information about that. But though being given that my main patron is Anubis, there are certain things, at least in modern day, that I can't get. Like most priests of Anubis have a leopard skin. I can't get leopard skin. I will settle for faux, but I can't get real. And that's basically to symbolize Anubis's victory over Set. So when Osiris was first being mummified for the first time, the first process of the mummification, Set turned into a leopard to try to disrupt Anubis in the process. But Anubis saw that, took a knife, flayed Set in his leopard form, and
Yikes.
draped his skin over his shoulder as a sign of victory of no, you're not messing with me. Just because I'm quiet and I'm calm does not mean you get to mess with me.
So it was like it seems to me to be like a story of his protection of the dead. His kind of like death is a serene pro like a gentle process.
It should not be disrupted. Like, and it's funny how even in Egyptian myth, to like, there's one, like the fight between Horus and Set is a lot more than just what that very, very obnoxious movie adds forth. Though it would have been a lot of fun if they were more accurate.
Which movie are you
They
referencing?
were God of Egypt, gods of Egypt.
I didn't see it.
Yeah, I watched it just out of sheer curiosity.
Yeah, I mean, we all watch our trash.
Whatever. Yeah, trash. But one of the ways that Set was over able to the fight between Horus and Set is always ongoing, and it's the cause of earthquakes and such. But there's also some times where Horus takes Set and vice versa. And that is meant to be a sexual reference because it was a
So
symbol of
they
domination.
okay, so they're showing like the their like the dominance over each other through like sexual acts and things like that. Very similar to like how animals, I guess, would be.
Though I again, that movie would have been a lot better if Gerard Butler. If
Well,
those two were in a scene, that would be so much more entertaining. But the
then you'd be
ratings
like, well, that was a great movie. Let's all watch it.
very accurate. I love it. 10 out of 10.
What are some of the rituals of Kemeticism? I'm curious. Like I know I was there for the Hathor Sekhmet feast day ritual, which the ritual itself actually seemed pretty simple. If I remember, there was the candles. You had a particular incense. Did you bring an incense? I can't remember.
It's an incense blend I have of frankincense, myrrh, cinnamon, and amber. It's kind of a blend that my gods enjoy, so I kind of use that as my all-purpose temple blend. There is a blend in Egyptian Kemeticism called Khafre. The process is annoying as hell to make.
To make this incense, it's an entire ritual almost in and of itself. Like,
Wait,
there's
like,
days
the
long.
incense is called Capri? Nice.
Which Khepri is also the name of a god.
Really?
Yes, it
Dung, I
is.
know this one, may I? I've been real quiet. Is a dung beetle who helps Ra split from Osiris with the rebirth and push the card along.
Huh.
Is that
Yeah,
it?
Well, I mean, I didn't want to dive into like a whole long explanation, but this is a short summary.
it's the very the short one. Khafre is one of the aspects of Ra, which again is another phrase you hear a lot in Kemeticism. He is Ra in the morning, the very, very early morning, and the Egyptian clock is way different.
So he's Ra before his coffee?
Except for he has a scarab on his head.
I know, I feel like the Egyptian gods are going to smite me for my little comments. It's terrible.
No.
What I found very interesting in your ritual with the Hathor Sekhmet ritual was the kneeling, and so we all had to kneel and kind of bow. I think it was 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never done that in a ritual before because I'm very on the fence about gods in general and like how I feel about them and stuff like that. So to have to put myself in that kind of position that was almost like a, you know, like I worship you, you're higher than me, you know what I mean, like you're more powerful than me and stuff like that. It was, I mean, I did it because I was respectful of the ritual that we were doing, and I'm not gonna just, you know, it's like you just don't do that. It's just, it's bad. It's just, it's not good to do. Bad taste. It's
bad etiquette.
Exactly. It's bad etiquette. So, but I just found that really interesting. So is a lot of Kemeticism like that? Is it like you're worshiping them? Like you are giving them your devotion? Is it like that? Or is it like we're equals?
It depends. You can work with a deity and as well as worship them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I worship Ra, but I don't work with Ra.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I did, I'd get smote every time I make my own comments about the sun.
Ah.
And I have, yes, I work with Anubis and Hathor and Sekhmet and Thoth and Isis and Sobek. There's a lot. as well as one of the things I would love to do with my altar more is have different things. Like, I'm on the hunt for crocodile pieces for Sobek, because that was sacred in the temples of Sobek.
Mm-hmm.
They mummified, that's why you see mummified crocodiles.
Mm.
It's not because they were weird, no. That those crocodiles were meant to be Sobek himself.
It's funny that Jay mentioned the prostrating at the altar when you did the ritual. I do find that I'm not quite sure, even for me, that was a little, you know,
jarring.
As an animist, I mean, I do believe that there are some of my spirits that I work with are incredibly powerful things that when they come, when I call them up and they appear, you know, some of the way that I know is kind of the hair on the back of my neck. And I begin to feel very small in their presence. So it's not to say that I don't get this idea that, you know, they chose, but they are primordial powers. But prostrating was weird for me too. Prostrating in front of God was always weird for me.
Yeah, especially like, or like in church, like kneeling in the pew. Like I never liked that.
I didn't either, but it was, I mean, all in all, though, I will admit, I do love the, I actually love the energy that you, when you, like, it's not an easy task to, when you call on your gods, to really be able to bring them forth. I you know, in my experience, gods have always been very, or spirits have always been very fickle,
mm-hmm.
and they're kind of like, yeah, mm-hmm. maybe this time, maybe next time, I don't know. I'll answer the phone later, you know, like, but when you do, when I'm in the room with you and you do something, it's this very palpable atmospheric change that I'm like, in all honesty, I always kind of, and I'm not trying to insult anybody, but I always felt like that's how I should have felt in Catholic Mass,
mm-hmm.
like, sense of holy, divine presence, like they have this very regal, you know, fear not, you know, this very bright light, sort of, not in like a white light kind of way, but just in like a, like,
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. So it's kind of like in my experience with being in a Catholic church or a Catholic mass, it was very much it felt like, okay, we're gonna open the book and we're gonna read the same things that we've been reading, and we're just gonna blah 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 and kind of like get through it. Okay, take your communion and I'll see you next week. It's kind of how it felt because it's been like the same. I don't know. It's like this, like the like yeah, he's a priest and everything, but it didn't feel divine. It didn't feel, there was no sense of reverence for what was going on. But Darian, when you did that ritual, you and it's because you're a bit younger than me. I think you're, how old are you? Like what, 26? Three, three. My God, you're young. So I'm 29. I'm gonna be 29 in a couple days, so that's like a considerable difference in age. And I always kind of, oh, it's Darian, he's young, he's this, he's that. And when you did that ritual, you became a priest in my eyes. Like I could see that. Like you're in this. Like you're not dabbling. Like you're not a dabbler, I guess, is what it really was. It's like you're not a dabbler. You're not just doing this because it's fun or this or that. Like you're doing it because like you're into it. And you could tell that this is your thing, that you are committed to this thing. Which is why I really wanted to talk to you more, or to have you on here to talk more about this, because you also mentioned that you do practice a lot of dragon magic, and I was curious if that same, because I haven't done any dragon magic with you. I was curious if that same reverence is carried into your work with dragons.
Actually, the reverence part, yes, but the way I see my dragons and the way I see my gods is different but the same. My gods, I do see them and respect them as a higher being, but my dragons, I always refer to them as kin. Like, we are equals. You come to me because you want to, not because of any obligations.
So would you say that you share the opinion about your dragons the same way Jay and I see your dragons are spirits, like powerful, inhuman, primal forces, right? Sort of not necessarily gods, but something other.
Yes, something that would quite literally burn you to
Something still
pieces.
powerful, still
Yes.
incredibly powerful, but I mean I get that. I get that vibe.
But when I'm with my dragons, I'm very much so so effectively I have four dragons that I work with mainly. Well, technically eight, but my four dragons are the two, I have two of the same kind and then two different kinds. I have two European dragons, in that Western very, when you think of dragon, that's the first thing you see is the European style. I have a lung,
You
which
mean like
is
with
a
wings and
tail, horn, stuff like
four
that.
D and D dragon, D and D dragon.
Yeah,
Yeah, the dragon.
exactly. Yep.
I have a lung, which is more of an Eastern style. And then the new addition, which is a Emhyr, which is a dragon that doesn't have arms or legs, but just wings and a head. Have you ever seen Fantastic Beasts? It's like the Alchemy, but more snake-like. And it's funny, when it comes to my dragons, I very much so always keep it very neutral, because unless they present themselves as either male or female, they, it's always they. But for my, I also have the four primal elemental dragons, Fafnir, Nelion, Ceres, and Graio. I like, if shit's hitting the fan and I need help big time, I summon, or at least I call on those four, because those four are one of the representations of the four base elements: fire, earth, water, and air.
This is great because I actually know exactly what you're talking about, because so today earlier, so Joyce picked up an Amazon Flex like kind of side gig thing, and I went along, and it was like a 4-hour drive, and I actually read cover to cover DJ Conway's Dancing with Dragons I was like, I really need to brush up on my dragon lore and dragon magic information, and so I read the whole book in like 4 hours today right before recording this. And so when you were naming all this, yeah, I was like, oh my god, I actually know what you're talking about. This is great.
It's funny how you mention her. Unfortunately, when it comes to working with dragons, literally, whatever they show you is whatever they show you. Don't say anything.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was picking up in this book.
If you work with dragons, you are secretive.
Yeah.
Like a dragon. You live in your cave and you will like it.
Mm-hmm.
So bless her heart. It's funny, when Scott told me about her passing, I was like, well, she's flying with dragons now.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, could not remember. I'm glad you mentioned that she did pass, because I couldn't remember. I was like, I feel like this is something I feel like she is gone, but I couldn't remember if she was or not. When did she pass? Was it recently? I think.
Beginning of some point in like mid 2019 to the end of,
so it was fairly recent then.
It was like it was recent, because it could even been at the end of 2019.
Yeah. She's actually written a ton of books, but actually a couple on dragon magic in particular, and some of the things that I was picking up on, especially what she was what she was talking about in her dragon magic, is you have to like kind of approach it with a sense of like childlike curiosity, because dragons themselves have an almost childlike curiosity, which I thought was so cool. And it kind of set me down like a little bit of this like rabbit hole kind of path in my head, because I was like, okay, so, and how you were saying earlier, Darren, how you don't know if dragons will present themselves as male or female, and so you just use kind of they when you're initially contacting them and working with them. And I was like, I'm looking at her book, Dancing with Dragons, I'm like, kind of, it seems like dragon magic is kind of, like, inherently queer in its nature. Because you're approaching it from a place of innocence, so it makes you go back to, like, ground zero within yourself, and you're just supposed to just be completely open to whatever it is that they want to show you. And so it just reminds me of like being a kid, you know what I mean? And like, if I could go through, it's kind of like if I was a kid and someone said to me, hey, you know, you're a boy and that's okay, and I'd be like, oh, okay, you know what I mean? Like, it just kind of like just to be like completely open to that concept. It just seems like dragon magic is inherently queer to me.
I mean, a lot of ancient things are inherently queer.
Yes.
That one.
It's very true. Very true. I think, Scott, you were going to say something?
I was just going to say, like, I one of the things I absolutely love about Darren's dragon magic is how very ecstatic it is. It relies it relies on ecstatic trance states, and it relies on your spiritual feelings and your intuition and your psychic mind. I love that it's this like you said, it's all about that creative inner child, you know. And I think it is inspiring. I always thought it was really interesting.
Like each of my main four dragons, each one of them has like an item or like a crystal. Like, I'll just be like, every once in a while when they get too dusty, I'll wash them and just check in and see if they want to come out or not. Or because the statues on my altar, they're vessels, yes. For those four, well, three, I still have not found the fourth one. But, like, my one of my Europeans, they're very much so like, no, this is a good place to, we'll go down, I'll sleep for a while, if you need me, I'm here. But other than that, go away. Like, when Scott mm-hmm. tries to reach something on my altar.
Oh, one time, yeah! One time, I went to look at one of his carnelian stones, because I was comparing it to one of mine. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that my stone wasn't dyed. Mm. And, I wasn't even thinking about it, and I went to grab the carnelian stone, but his carnelian stones kind of rest almost sort of in the statue of this particular dragon spirit that he mm. has for the you know, and I without even thinking about it, I felt a sharp pain, almost like a it just felt sharp. It felt like a bite. I got bit by something. Yeah. Yeah, and I was like, ah. I was like, what the hell? I thought, as much as I love you, babe, he could be a little messy. And I thought somehow he like had like a pin or something in there, like accidentally.
So you thought it was just like a physical thing.
There was nothing in there, but something bit me. You know what I mean? Like, wow. And I wasn't, and the thing is, like, I wasn't thinking about it. Like, I genuinely was like, I was completely just practical, mundane nonsense. I was like, is this dyed? You know what I mean? And I was mm-hmm. like going to check. I wasn't even doing anything witchy.
Right.
I mean, I was looking at my crystals, but that's about it. Like, I wasn't, you know, oh, I need to work with this. It was just admiring my crystals, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, something happened, so.
Yeah, and then I had to explain to him that the way that particular statue is, it's a dragon that's looking inside of a cave where I house the carnelians. And I'm just like, you realize that those are probably like a representation of eggs. Therefore, protect. Don't fuck with eggs.
And it's interesting, too, because carnelian, folklorically, was always a very hot stone. It was always... it's a stone of will and heat and fire and... You know, it's like a stone of passion, so it's interesting for, too, that he has that kind of interesting perspective.
Well, it's funny. Unfortunately, when my dragons want something from me, they usually speak in riddles, sometimes. At least my Europeans speak in riddles. My Lung does not speak riddles. He speaks exactly what he wants when he wants it. Like, when my European wanted a carnelian, it was literally, find me a stone that's as red as fire. I'm like, now I have to decipher this. I have mm-hmm. to figure out what they mean by certain things. It's like, can't just give me a straight answer. The Lung, I have a pearl. Like, literally for my Lung dragon is, I want a fan, I want a mirror, I want a pearl.
Hmm. And there was just, I gotta find dragons like that to work with. It's actually kind of funny that I have Conway's book, because I think I originally bought it for myself, and then a friend of ours, Rick, he's super it would be a disservice to him to say that he's super into dragons, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, he is a dragon himself. And then I kind of gave it to him because I was like, hey, you should do this, because you should do dragon magic, because why the fuck not. And then I think he wanted me to like help him do a ritual or something, and then he gave the book back to me to reference the book, and so now I have the book again. So I've actually never done any dragon magic, but after today, after reading the book cover to cover, dragon magic, like with all magic, you have to approach it from a place of sincerity and seriousness. I just want to kind of put that out there as a blanket statement. Don't dabble. Especially,
don't dabble with dragons.
Don't dabble with dragons.
Spirit work.
Yes, I almost want to say, and Conway actually says this in her book. Like, she says, like, do not do that. She literally says, like, just stick to candle spells if you want to dabble. And I was like, yeah, damn, like that was like strict. I felt like that was like mom, you know, like yelling at you. Like, look, if you're gonna do it, just either be serious or just stick to your whatever the hell it is you're doing over there. And I was like, okay. And I liked that, you know, I liked seeing that in a book. But I am actually really, really intrigued by this. I think especially right now, with how weird the world is and everything that's going on, I think dragon magic is what could actually be incredibly therapeutic for a lot of people.
Yes, it would be. Oh, I'm sorry, Sophia.
No, I was literally saying, yeah, fucking why not?
Yeah. Especially because it comes from a place of utmost sincerity, and it required, and what she was also writing in the book, and a lot of what, like what you were saying earlier, Scott, about how it's a very ecstatic practice, like how Darien does it is very ecstatic. That's how Conway describes it in this book. It is a very ecstatic practice, and you wouldn't think so. Because when I originally thought what dragon magic was, I thought it was incredibly ceremonial. That's what I really thought it was. I thought it was going to be very, like, do this, do the thing at this precise hour, at this precise time. I thought it was, like, you know, quote-unquote...
Nah, bruh, you're thinking fucking Solomonic Hermetic.
Yeah, I thought it was along those lines. And then I read this whole book today, and I'm like, this seems like some of the... I don't want to say easiest, because no magic is particularly easy. Magic isn't easy. But I think it is one of the... I think it's a good... It's simple to get started because of the approach to it. Because you're supposed to approach it from a place of sincerity and have the most open mind and kind of revert
and
back...
innocence, you were saying.
Yeah, and a sense of innocence. And dragons are incredibly intelligent, so if you come into dragon magic and you're pretending like you're innocent and you're lying, like, they can read everything about you. They know what you're about before you know what you're about.
If I may just then interject, all y'all try-hard chaos magicians who might listen to this and be like, I can paradigm shift! I mean, you're welcome to try, but they're probably gonna fucking know.
There are, dragons that do have a lot of association with chaos and
that begs the whole conversation about how chaos magic actually isn't about chaos, that that's actually a mispronunciation of a whole bunch of stuff, but that's not what this episode's about.
But
I think that I was actually going to mention, so that's a good segue for me though. I also love dragon magic because of how the areas of which dragons are from, it's not just the four basic elements, it's like moments of nature, it's also like planetary powers, you know, dragons of the star signs and dragons of the planetary powers and dragons of the time of day and dragons of a concept of chaotic in nature and you know, things like storm and these kind of very primal, you know, concepts, these very although simple archetypes but moving and potent, you know what I mean? I think that's
awesome.
You
really hit on the nail. Another thing when it comes to dragons, is a little bit of a more or less a catch 22, if I'm using that phrase right. Like, you can cast all the spells you want with dragons if you want, call upon all names. But dragons are, and Jay, you especially, you know this from reading Conway's book, they're picky.
Yes.
They're very picky off who they want to even work with them.
They're like cats.
Yes. Literally toothless.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, and that's one of the reasons I love that those movie franchise and the sub-franchises. I love them so much. Plus, they have, like, really amazing concepts of what dragons can do.
Yeah.
Well, that's beside the point. But when I work with my dragons, like, hey, come on, we're going for a walk. Or not really, like, for a walk, as in, like, say, for a dog.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, hey, I'm going for a walk if you want to come with me.
Come with me.
Yeah.
Like, there was one time where I was trying to call one dragon, but I accidentally called another dragon altogether, which is very dangerous. I cannot stress that enough. If you are going to contact a dragon, focus and make sure you have the right dragon in mind, because it could end up terribly. I got lucky because I accidentally summoned a Twilight Dragon, which was very beautiful. They were very beautiful but terrifying thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was, and even Scott, it was like a dragon that is gold and a deep purple, but it was so, and like the, because it was in the backyard,
mm-hmm.
and then it was just during twilight, of course, but then when it came down, it was like, it gave me a little bit of a lesson,
mm-hmm.
and flew off. It said what it had to say, and it went away.
And I kind of just want to say one thing about dragons in general. So, dragons are astral beings. So, when we're talking about dragon magic, we're not talking about actually literally summoning a physical flying reptilian creature in this world. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a physical manifestation. Now, what Conway was saying in her book is that there have been instances where, you know, there's, because if you're a witch, you know this happens all the time. There are instances in which this plane of existence, this realm and the astral, they collide, and you know, that's when you see actual manifestations of things in the astral plane. But that's just kind of something I wanted to clarify for anyone who may be a little bit on the fence about dragons. Dragons are spirits and entities, just like any, just like a god that we would work with, just like a house spirit we would work with. They all exist in the astral realm. So they're all just, they're entities that we work with there.
Oh, it would be very, very, very fun. At least I call it the fun apocalypse.
Yeah, if dragons came through and took over.
Yeah, like, because people would not be prepared.
No.
I mean, not to say, like, the European variety, people would not be prepared, because when it comes to, like, the Eastern dragons, like, from China and Japan specifically, they're, like, dragons from Korea, India, like, those areas, those are, I'm not that well-versed, but I
mm-hmm.
am on my way of learning that much. There are a lot of dragons across the entire world, so I can't get to them all.
And I think that's...
How come I don't know any from North America? Like, I've heard of ones from, like, South and Central America, but there's no stories that I've ever heard of for, like, Northern American areas.
Actually, there is. It's not a dragon, but is a dragon-like entity. A horned serpent.
I have heard of,
Okay, there's a few. There's actually, if I think about it really hard, there's Ogopogo, actually. But those are, like, water serpents. That'd be something similar almost to, like, Loch Ness Monster. Like, the locals didn't consider that one, like, a dragon, per se.
That's actually really cool that you mentioned that, Sophia, because Conway talks about that in the book.
The Ogopogo?
Nessie, Loch Ness Monster.
Okay.
She was saying that Nessie is actually probably a dragon, just a sea dragon, you know, like a dragon mm-hmm. that has like affinity toward water, because dragons have affinities toward certain elements, and that would be just, you know, a water serpent or, you know, water dragon. So she kind of like takes the definition of dragon and really like expands it.
Okay.
She does a really great job in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll explain what Ogopogo is for y'all that don't know.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that before.
You probably wouldn't, because there's a very specific area in Canada called the Okanagan Desert. It's the only desert in Canada, and I know about it because I grew up right on the edge of it, where it meets the Kootenai Pine Forest. And in the Okanagan Lake, it's huge, huge lake. There's been legends for as long as people have lived there of this thing called the Ogopogo, which is like a massive sea serpent, essentially, that lives in the freshwater lake. There's been like searches for it. There are like statues erected to it around the town. It does kind of look similar to what one would depict a Eastern dragon looking similar to. It's essentially like a big elongated serpent that swims through the water.
Well, it's very
Yeah,
funny bit because Eastern dragons actually use the in a lot of Chinese and Japanese myths, what the dragons of those lands, they live in water. They live in the oceans and the rivers and sometimes the sky. Sometimes. But like if you go further south of the border towards like Mexico, one Aztec dragon is like a more or less a giant serpent, a Quetzalcoatl,
Yeah.
which is he's one of those dragon god deities. I put him like on the same pedestal as I would Tiamat, which she is a primordial
Babylonian.
remember, Meso not Mesoamerican, Mesopotamian.
Yeah.
Mesopotamian goddess of primordial chaos, and she is creator, yes, but she is the primordial chaos.
She's, well, not alone. She
Not
has
alone.
Apsu, who is the god of the sweet waters, like order, and Tiamat is the goddess of the I don't know exactly, I don't know if it was like rough waters or what, but basically chaos, like, you know, order and chaos. They're night and day and light and
Yeah.
dark.
And then also in
Like
one of the myths, what was it? Tiamat or Tiamat, however you pronounce that. Tiamat had a son, Marduk, however you would pronounce
Oh,
that.
Marduk, yeah, who is famed for destroying the Tower of Babylon or Babel, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and also I think in the myths he killed his
Slays
mother,
Tiamat.
yeah, and created the world from her, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
You know, I actually have a really, it's, I'm actually really kind of excited this came up because, like, I have a very interesting opinion on things like Nessie and the Ogopogo and even like the Yeti and Bigfoot. I have come to the assumption that these beings are, I mean, exactly like what we're saying. They're spirits or ultra-terrestrials, if you will.
They're very real, is what you're saying.
Yeah, they like they exist kind of off center of our reality, but they break through. You know what I mean? Which is why, you know, people like, it's funny because like the more I read about, you know, I'm not like one of those people that would go hunt a Bigfoot, but the more I read about that, the more I realize that Bigfoot comes with strange synchronistic paranormal occurrences. Why
UFOs
would this, you know?
specifically.
Huh?
I said UFOs specifically is what's accompanied by Bigfoot.
Really?
Yeah, there's the suppose. I mean,
Oh
there's a loose
yeah.
relation here.
Oh yeah.
You know, and which is why I like, which is why I subscribe to the belief that UFOs are actually from here. They're not from outer space. They're from here. They're ultra terrestrial, not, you know, space travel. It's like
Well, I
there's
mean,
gaps in reality, or at least
I
our.
saw one up. Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead and repeat your thing. I'll say what I was going to say after.
No, I just tend to think that these things are like gaps in, you know, the worlds, if you will. Glimpses into the ethereal and the mystical.
Interesting, 'cause I'm not going to necessarily give the full story here on a podcast, but I did have a very close encounter with a UFO one time. And by close encounter, I mean like about 150 to 200 feet away from me, sort of close. In metric, about 100 meters. Yeah, it was really intense. So I don't know. Some of these, it's one thing to say that they are, like, I can't remember the exact term you used there, Scott, but at the same time, like, I don't know about UFOs specifically, because that thing was real as fucking hell, and a lot of people that I know who I brought back to see it verified it, and it wasn't just like me seeing it, and I was on call with like my mom and my sister, and I had my girlfriend at the time. Like all, I had four witnesses with me, you know, and we all saw the damn thing. So like, I don't know. There is a very real aspect to it in some regard, and not all of the things sometimes are just astral too.
I
We
think like
especially
too.
don't know. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you were done. I'm so sorry.
I was gonna say, we especially don't know with UFOs because it's in their name. They're fucking unknown. We don't even, we, all that we can approach them with it is just conjecture, you know?
Yeah, I the only like I mean my real big I mean I've always kind of thought this about ultra-terrestrial, more about reality hopping than it is for me anyway about I mean I do believe on a scientific level that we like it's statistically highly unlikely that we're the only living things, you know,
In the universe.
in the universe. I mean it like even scientists would agree to this, you know. There's a lot of like these cryptid situations that come with strange paranormal phenomena that you know telepathy sort of odd psychic phenomena telekinetic phenomena that's something really popular with the Bigfoot. You hear a lot of stories where people are attacked by the Bigfoot and it starts throwing rocks that are like, you know, the big ass boulders, but no one particularly sees it. It just these you hear it and it starts throwing things at you, but from nowhere, right? So it's sort of like has this apport, you know, instantaneous, you know. Obviously, I'm probably getting a little bit, says Sophia says a little tinfoily here, but you know, if Sophia could do it, so can I.
Oh, I mean, don't get me wrong. I know that there is a lot of shit that I call tinfoil that is real as fuck. But I call it tinfoil because, like, there's a certain level of, I don't know, something about talking about it, you know? Like, it's one thing to be like, yeah, man, UFOs are real. But it's another thing to be like, UFOs are real, you know?
Yeah. It's kind of like Chris and Tara in their book *Besom, Stang, and Sword*. How they include the Jersey Devil as like an entity in their area. Like they're from New Jersey. The Jersey Devil is a very popular, prominent myth and part of their folklore, and they honor the Jersey Devil as a local land spirit in
Yeah,
their practice.
above that, they've kind of I believe I've seen Tara kind of compare the Jersey Devil to Abuka, which Abuka is supposed to be a horned man. So Abuka were a group of horned spirits, so like the witch's devil, but they were land spirits, and these beings were intelligent and very magical. And it was believed that different places regionally had a buka that was specifically their own. And if I'm not mistaken, I think I've seen Tara on her Facebook, her personal Facebook, discussing the buka and the Jersey Devil. So I thought that was really interesting.
So I don't want to pull this too far off of the original topic, but while we're literally talking about it, that's very similar to the Leshy or Leshin from European folklore that in popular culture is often depicted as a person that's essentially a living deer skeleton that stands upright like a human being would, sometimes wearing like a cloak of fur, sometimes with a body of darkness, sometimes with a body made from earthen things such as twigs and vines and lichen. And they are and they often the one of the prominent features is animal skulls for like the heads of them, sort of thing.
Normally horned, yep. The there are a lot of people believe that there is
Stag is a favorite.
a certain cultural a certain cultural exchange there. A lot of people believe the buka from I don't want to say Wales. I'm almost 100% certain Scotland and East Anglia in England. And Cornwall, I believe, I'm not 100%, but definitely, you know, definitely Cornwall. So, like, certain older parts of England, Scotland, and I'm not 100%, but possibly Wales. So, and of course, the Germanic, Nordic areas as well. So, come, you know, with the Leshy.
What's one thing that I always like to remember, though, is that, like, the spirits all around the world are as unique as the people who live on it. So, like, you don't really encounter Ifrits or Ifriti in North America, you know?
Right.
And it's really cool how spirits really are regional. And North America really is this mix mash because there's, like, a bunch of old indigenous culture that still remains but is greatly lost. Like, I don't have any anything passed down to me on my dad's Métis side for story and stuff, but there is, like, that rich legend of the land with all these stories that don't really get told anymore, you know? And it's cool how, like, dragons really did fit into a lot of them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what they really are, but they're definitely cool.
From what it sounds like, it seems like we need to do a whole episode on, like, cryptids and land spirits.
No.
No?
Yeah. No, because then you're going to make me start talking about stuff that I shouldn't actually talk about on a podcast.
Hmm. But now it just makes me so curious about what it is that you can't talk about in a podcast.
I will talk about it after the call, my dude.
Yeah, I'm curious about that
one. But, anyway, let's, you know, obviously respect Sophia's wishes.
Oh, I know. I'm going to.
You'll know why after.
Just me being me. It's the inner, I guess, journalist in me that's like, but why? I want to know.
Well, you'll find out. Give it 10 minutes.
Well, then I guess maybe we'll record that conversation for ourselves, and maybe after reviewing it and highly editing it, maybe we'll release it as, like, a bonus episode After Dark content, maybe.
Bloopers.
I'm willing to bet you won't, but I'll humor you.
We'll see. We'll see. So, I think I've kind of battered Darian with all of the questions that I've particularly had about Cometicism, especially just in terms of what he can answer in this podcast. So Darian, if anyone was looking into, like, learning more about it, getting involved, whatever the case is, what are some places that you would suggest they turn to?
For Cometicism?
Yes, for Cometicism.
The earlier, the Circle of Isis and Heka.
Mm-hmm.
I will probably, you know, I'll probably actually take a picture of both of them and post it on the Witches Betwixt Facebook.
Okay. Yeah, just, that would be perfect.
Would you also say the Book of the Dead?
Yes. Oh, thank you so much for reminding me about that. Mm-hmm. The Egyptian Book of the Dead. Not what the mummy, not remotely what the mummy has shown.
The movie, yeah. So is there an actual English there is an actual English translation of the mummy, Book of the Dead? Okay. Is there a particular translation that you prefer?
Actually, the one I have does have hieroglyphic text and the English underneath of it.
Okay.
I just don't remember where I put it, which is so unfortunate.
Yeah,
okay.
But unfortunately, the Book of the Dead is like the Bible. It's incredibly dry.
Mm-hmm. So you have to extract things from it that you need.
Yeah, you kind of have to. It's just, it's really hard to, like, sit down and read it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the book is like a whole 3 inches thick.
Now, I guess for my final kind of question, like, when it comes to Cometicism, would you say that it is a practice, like, since a lot of it is lost to history, and a lot of it is based off of translation, you know, things always get lost in translation. Is it something that you think is a more academic, like, you would be better pursuing it academically, like, reading as much as you can about ancient Egypt, or do you think it's something that you should practice in a more ecstatic, meditative kind of way?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. It's actually a little bit of both. To bring back to the ritual earlier, that I guess I've researched it, but what I did was my own ecstaticness. Mm-hmm. A lot of what I do with my Kemeticism is somewhat ecstatic.
Okay.
I mean, given the feel of it, it does feel like a church, if you want to put it like that, but it is mm-hmm. very much so. I'm extrapolating what I know to put it into a workable thing.
Okay. I mean, so that concept is... What were you saying, Scott?
I would say, I mean, from what I've seen him do, it seems to me, it seems you need to be able to, you know, read and study and research to get context,
mm-hmm.
and then practice, so that way the spirits of the tradition, the gods of the tradition, can kind of guide you further mm-hmm. beyond mm-hmm. what we know. It seems like from helping him do his research.
So it seems like do your homework, do your research to build a strong foundation, but then from there kind of let the practice itself guide you, is kind of what you're saying?
Yeah.
That makes sense. Makes sense. I feel like that's kind of true of witchcraft too, because there's only so much you can read that's based off of, you know, old texts and this and that, and at a certain point you have to put the books down and just do, and just yeah. do the work, you know, get into the practice.
From a folk magician, I mean, like, there's a point, and even a traditional witch, there's a point to where, like, you come to realize that history is history, and we weren't there.
Right.
As much as scholars do know is also as much as they don't know.
Correct.
So, you know, there is a lot that was lost to time that we'll never get back, at least not in this life, or not in this form, not in this body, but,
right.
You know, so a lot of all of these reconstructed pagan traditions are still valid, but they're reconstructed, you know, with the information that we know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And also for dragon magic, from what I understand, I feel like dragon magic is kind of something that you experience more so than you study.
Mm-hmm.
You work with the dragons themselves. Like, you build a good foundation with good ritual structure, but it seems like you have to, it's more of a feeling, it's more of a practice than like an academic pursuit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, sometimes I'll, like if my dragons want me to do something,
mm-hmm.
like, very specific, I'll just get, like, a nagging feeling in my head. I'm just like, why does that keep popping up in my head?
Mm-hmm.
Like, a while ago, like, I just kept saying the same image over and over and over again. Me, backyard, three statues, cauldron, fire. I'm like, what do you want me to do? What is this? And I had to I had to kind of pry it out of them just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. Just very much so.
But as a good foundation, you seem to really like Conway's works. The book that I've been referencing this whole time is Dancing with Dragons by G.J. Conway. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that's the same book you kind of were referencing. Yeah.
Dancing with Dragons is a very good foundation. That's the first out of the three books.
Yeah, I think she has two more.
I just got her last book. I still haven't cracked it open, but her second book is a lot more.
I don't remember the name of it all of a sudden.
It's over there, actually.
I see another one listed on here, Mystical Dragon Magic.
Yes, that's the second book.
It's okay. A grimoire, spellbook.
Yeah, that's more of a. That's less of a guide and more of a.
Yeah, so it's more of a spellbook.
Yeah, it's. To put us like Scott is literally a spell book. It's, but you have to go through, like, you can't just read it through. It's meant to be, there's guided meditations, there's spells. Like, I still haven't gone through all of the way because I still need to, there's some things I need to, like, do personally,
mm-hmm.
like, to do within my own self. And that's why I just found the fourth dragon that I'm working with. She's coming along to help me with a little bit. which is kind of a product of a spell I did a very, very long time ago.
Huh. That's pretty interesting.
As much as I'm going to say, because...
Can't say.
Yeah.
That's fair.
As nice as the other three, unfortunately.
So yeah, it kind of seems like when it comes to dragons, it's a little bit of like a secretive kind of thing, because dragons are innately secretive and cryptic, and they like to speak in riddles, and they're not exactly always the most forthcoming, so it's sort of a practice that you have to evolve with it as you're getting into it. But having a strong foundation is incredibly important, or else things can go awry very quickly, because dragons are very powerful entities, and if you're not handling them responsibly, then you'll pay the consequences for it. That's for sure. Did anyone else have any additional questions for Darian or clarification on anything? I think we can kind of wrap up this episode and get into the after dark of things that we can't say on the podcast discussion, which I'm excited for.
Oh, I think, you know, of course I know more, but
okay.
I think I'm good.
Okay. Well, thank you, Darian. I'm glad you actually had off work today. That's...
Me too.
That's really nice to see that you're not at work all the time. So we're gonna wrap it up here. So for anyone who is new to the podcast, we are on the big three social medias: Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our handle is Witches Betwixt, all one word, on all three platforms. We all check each one except Twitter, which is pretty much exclusively run by me, but feel free to message us on any of them and we will get back to you. If you want to add your post to our online community, use the hashtag WBTWXT. And the links to our official Facebook group, Discord server, and website are in the show notes below. And we will see you in the next episode.
Bye.
Don't forget to banish.